Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and today on the program, Salt Lake City reveals the planned locations of four new homeless shelters to mixed reaction from residents. Former USU football player Torrey Greene, accused of seven counts of sexual assault, is denied bail. Utah Representative Chris Stewart weighs in on the question of Russian influence in the U.S. election, saying that he doesn't believe the meddling was intended to help anyone in particular. And Donald Trump's cabinet takes shape. We'll hear about the effect his picks might have in Utah. Those stories, your underplayed stories of the week, and more coming up on Behind the Headlines here on Utah Public Radio. Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, Salt Lake City announces the location of new homeless shelters. A former USU football player accused of multiple counts of sexual assault is denied bail. Utah Representative Chris Stewart weighs in on Russia's influence on the election. The president-elect's cabinet takes shape and much more. And joining me for this discussion, Salt Lake Tribune health and education reporter Alex Stuckey. Good morning, Alex.
Morning.
Government reporter Christopher Smart is here. Welcome, Chris.
Good morning, everybody.
Government reporter Robert Gerke as well. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And editorial writer George Pyle, thanks to you as well.
Good morning.
Good morning. Listeners, you can join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255 or comment at sltrib.com. Let's lead off today with a Salt Lake City story. Christopher Smart, the city unveiled the location of four new homeless resource centers, which they say is part of a new strategy on homelessness. First off, where are these shelters going? Also, what's happening to the old shelter, the road home?
Okay, so we've been waiting with bated breath for weeks for these announcements. It's actually the culmination of 2 years of discussion. One of these new 150-bed homeless shelter slash resource centers, as they're being called, is in the Sugar House area, and it's about 2300 south and just west of 7th East on Simpson Avenue,
right.
653 Simpson, and it's in a small commercial district, but it abuts a residential neighborhood. The others aren't as controversial. The Deseret Industries location on 7th South, just above State, will be one of these resource centers. A resource center will be located at 648 West on 1st South. That's sort of down by the UTA bus barns.
Right.
And then the fourth location is at 245 West High Avenue, which is 1400 South, and that right now is a junkyard. So those are the four. The one at Sugar House is very controversial. Another, you know, topic that you mentioned is that there has been talk that these four 150-bed resource center shelters, that's 600 beds. And somehow that these will be operated in a new and different way, rendering the road home on Rio Grande useless. Well, and that place can house up to 1,100.
Okay, so 150 beds for four locations, that's 600 beds, 1,100 beds at road home, a loss of 500 beds. The city, though, says, as you pointed out, that this is part of a new strategy and that they're going to eliminate the need for beds.
Okay, so the city selected the sites. The county, in its collective impact initiative, are the ones who are coordinating services. And so they're the ones who are really setting up this new model. And the focus on the new model is that folks who are mentally ill or suffer from addiction will not be in those facilities. They will be in specialized facilities that look into those specifics.
For that strategy to work, in addition to building, obviously, these new locations, you would imagine that there would have to be a pretty serious investment in the services that you're describing. I mean, beyond building a location with beds, you have to have staff doing that. Who will carry out that work?
So this is something that we don't know exactly yet. It's going to cost more money, both for these types of services I just mentioned, plus it's going to cost more money for more caseworkers on site. And the key to this, I'm told by the collective impact people, is something called flow. That is, how long do people stay in the shelter? The new program wants to take them in, assess them, get them what they need, get them in housing much quicker than we are now. There is a significant segment of folks at the road home who stay there 3 to 4 weeks. They're in, they're out. There's another significant segment who are there for a year. And so what they want to do is concentrate on that group and have develop special housing programs to get them, and they need counseling, obviously, but to get them housed, because they don't want these shelters to be a place where you live. These are a place where you go, you get what you need, and you're gone.
Do we know the kind of money that we're talking about for those services, where that money will come from? And then also, is this something that's been done in other communities successfully?
Okay, so portions of this new plan have been done elsewhere. But to my knowledge, and what the people at Collective Impact say, is that this is the first time that they have taken all these different providers that we have, these service providers, and pulled them in to one group that is coordinated with each other. So that is to say, when somebody comes into the shelter, they will be assessed and they will get the services they need. They won't have to bump around, you know, like we do now, which is sort of unorganized. The question is, where does the money come from? That is going to be a big challenge. Collective Impact people recognize that the money will be a challenge, but this is dependent on a lot more services.
Does you know, I know that there was some state money set aside both for this dispersed site homeless shelter strategy, but also I'm assuming for some of these services. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So this year the ledge set aside $9.2 million. Advocates hope for similar numbers in the coming 2 years for a total of $27 million. Originally, there were going to be two shelters of 300. The city council box said, no, that's too much impact on any neighborhood. We're going to have four. That changes the arithmetic. So $27 million was supposed to be for the buildings and the services. Now, a big chunk of that money is going to be taken up by buildings, bricks and mortar.
I want to remind our listeners really quickly that you can join this conversations with your questions and comments. Maybe you live in one of the neighborhoods where these new shelters are slated to go. Weigh in with your comments. 801-355-8255. And I'd actually like to turn to that part of this story, Chris, that another kind of complaint, a predictable one really about this, is that some people in the neighborhoods where these shelters are going are understandably, I guess, upset about the announcement. And they were also upset about being kept in the dark for a while.
The city council and the mayor decided on a gambit, and that was they would do this outside public view. They would make these selections without public input. They said because they didn't want to pit one neighborhood against another.
Yeah.
One of the drawbacks of that was when these announcements were made earlier this week, people felt blindsided. And we've interviewed people in the Sugar House area there that are they're heartbroken, they're angry, they're beside themselves. Also, the shelter's going, the new planned shelter in Sugar House is planned for a lot where a preschool is now, Little Scholars.
Right.
And so the owners of the people who run Little Scholars and the parents who have their kids there they're just like, I can't believe it. They just feel like they've been blindsided. And that's the risk the council and the mayor took. And, they're paying for it this week. I mean, people are very angry. Some of the council people have been getting threatening emails. There was a meeting here two nights ago at Liberty Wells Community Council, which is Councilwoman Erin Mendenhall's district. And people were hot.
This is the Tracy Aviary a couple nights back. You know, the dispersed site plan, though, I mean, talking about this, we knew this was coming. We knew that it was going to be somewhere in the city. Obviously, any strategy that involves building new shelters in different neighborhoods is going to face some opposition in those neighborhoods. George Pyle, I'm wondering, something obviously has to be done to address what at least feels like a crisis in homelessness in Salt Lake City. Was this strategy the right way to go? I mean, keeping it secret for so long.
Well, as a journalist, I'm probably never going to stand up and say, you know, hooray for secrecy, because just generally that's not a good way to do things. And you're seeing the brunt of it now. People feel like they were blindsided and they didn't have any input into the process. But, you know, putting yourself in the position of the mayor and the council, you know, if they had opened it up and said, well, show of hands, who wants to host a homeless shelter, even if they call it a homeless resource center, and even if it's a lot smaller, and even if they've been saying for 3 years all the people who want to move the homeless out of Rio Grande because they want to redevelop it, and those pesky homeless people are in the way, even they were saying nobody is going to let us pick up the road home the way it is and put it down someplace else. That's just not an option. We've got to do something different. So right. If these plans all work, if they respect the neighborhoods, if they use the Sugar House site for the population that's women or women with children, which would be a lot less threatening than drug-addicted men wandering around, then it might still work.
Which is the plan right now.
That's what we've heard talked about. Yeah. They haven't completely worked all that, you know, which one goes where. That's part of the process they'll be working on. But at some point, they just had to say, okay, this is what we're going to do, or do nothing, which is what they've done forever, and just let the neighborhood continue to fall apart.
It seems like you're going to either pay the price politically before, or you're going to pay it after.
Exactly.
Now they're paying. They chose to pay it after, and they're paying the price now. It seems like if you have this outreach at the front end, then at least you get some buy-in, perhaps from some of the communities. You help, you know, get it tailored the way the community wants it. If they're going to have to accept this, and now just having it dropped on them, right, you can understand why. They're also
suffering from a lack of public relations. The city and the county didn't really reach out to the community and tell them, okay, this is going to be different. These are going to be designed so they turn inward. There's no queuing outside. All the meals are served inside. There's a courtyard for people so they hang out in this place. And then the exits will be away from the neighborhood. They didn't do that. What people are left with is the vision of Rio Grande Street, which is not only homeless people, but a lot of derelicts, drug dealers, you name it. And that's what people fear is going to come to their little neighborhood.
Well, the city, I'm curious about that, because it seems like they're trying to convey how this model is different from what has come in the past. We actually have a caller on the line right now who has a comment about this, Dr. Celia Mina. I hope I'm saying that right. You have a comment about this.
Yes, thank you. It's Dr. Celia Mina.
Thank you, Doctor.
I live in Salt Lake City, and I love this city. I have a son who's in the University of Utah Law School and has gotten 4 degrees in this city. I care about the future of this city. And what I watch just, I'm sorry to say, completely and utterly disgusts me, because invariably funds are raised, and I fully know that the amount of funds raised are very far in excess of what is being reported in the media. Very far in excess. Very far in excess. If I told you the true number of how much has been received to handle the homeless problem, you would be in shock. Where does this money go? I will tell you where it goes. It goes mainly, first and foremost, into the bank accounts of real estate developers. Secondarily, it goes to all of the people who benefit from delivering the services. Now, they justify that by saying, well, it creates jobs. That's all fine and dandy, except that's not supposed to be the actual target of these funds.
The stated aim.
It's supposed to be to help the homeless.
Dr. Mina, hold that thought. Chris Smart, this is a kind of common complaint about homeless provisions, or about plans to build new shelters, is that what's happening really is money is going to developers.
Yeah, that's news to me.
Okay.
I think there is an argument to be made that developers wanted that shelter on Rio Grande Street moved. I think that's plain as day. And the property owners down there, I think, would benefit greatly. One of the problems, you know, that area is wants to boom. It's really ready to go. When the shelter was moved there, put there in the late 70s, and it was designed for 400 people, there was nobody over there. But now it's the place for new hotels, new condos, new businesses. And that was, you know, the Pioneer Park Coalition was formed by a bunch of businessmen who wanted that to happen.
Well, Chris Martin, and this, we have lots of topics to cover on the show today. I'm realizing that we're taking quite a bit of time on this, but just on one, the Gateway Shopping Center, which is just across the street from the Road Home, on this topic, has a new owner and an owner that is investing a lot of property, a lot of money, actually, in the property there. Were the new owners of the Gateway at all aware that the Road Home would be eventually closing before they made their investment?
I doubt it, okay. Because we've been talking about this for years. But this, I think what happened was that the Gateway was a victim of both City Creek Center and the homeless crush down there. Businesses moved out of Gateway because of the homeless shelter, but it's a complex package. But the people who bought the Gateway are typically what they do is they go around the nation and they buy up these so-called troubled malls to turn them around. So this is fortuitous for them, no doubt. But this discussion has been going on long before these folks purchased the property.
You know, a couple of quick. I want to close out this topic by asking all of these shelters. George Pyle mentioned that in Sugar House, one of them might be dedicated to women and children. So all of these shelters are not providing the same services.
Each and one of these shelters will serve a distinct population within the homeless population. One will be designated for women only. That's because a lot of women don't dare go near a shelter for fear of being assaulted, or they've been in shelter and been assaulted. Another one is probably going to be mixed with, which would be moms and kids and maybe couples, that sort of thing. And probably two would be for men only, and they would be separated. They would separate those into groups depending on what the needs were for each one of those populations.
When will construction begin, and when will these facilities open?
Okay, so best case scenario, construction could begin in the spring. It is at least 2 years, best case scenario, before one of these will open. It's most likely going to be longer than that, but the legislature is pushing to get these things up and running as fast as possible.
Okay, well, this won't be the last time that we talk about this topic. That's for certain. Comprehensive reporting available at sltrib.com. We're going to have to take a quick break here. When we come back, we'll turn to the bail hearing of former USU football player Torrey Greene. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
This Week in This American Life. When Jennifer was 3, she lived in an all-black neighborhood in Milwaukee. One day she was riding her tricycle and saw an older white couple sitting on a bench.
Because I had never seen white people, I assumed that they were ghosts. So I waved, and I remember hearing, I thought, wow, that must be the way they talk.
Kid Logic, true stories, this week on This American Life.
Saturday morning at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
Holiday programming on Utah Public Radio is brought to you by our members and Dr. Paul Schmidt, practicing internal medicine with the team of physicians at the Budge Clinic, 1340 North, 500 East in Logan. Intermountain Clinics, wishing UPR listeners a safe and happy holiday season. Information at 435-716-1980.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines, the Salt Lake Tribune Reporter News Roundup. I'm Roger McDonough, joined this hour by the Tribune's Alex Stuckey, Robert Gerke, Christopher Smart, and George Pyle. Listeners, you can join this conversation with your questions and comments. Call us at 801-355-TALK or comment at sltrib.com. Alex Stuckey, former Utah State University football player Torrey Greene, accused of multiple counts of rape, was in court this week during a preliminary or actually a bail hearing. And his attorney was making the case that he should be released on bail. The judge in this case didn't agree, I think, correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay. What happened?
So basically his attorney's argument was he doesn't have a criminal record before this. There's no reason to suspect that he would be a danger because he's never been in trouble before, basically. However, you know, the prosecutors have pointed out in these seven alleged attacks that, you know, he's got a pattern. He picked most of the girls up at the same place, brought them back to his apartment. They turned on a movie and then he sexually assaulted them. And so the judge, I guess, agreed, if you will, that he would be a danger should he be let out on bail.
So seven charges. How many charges against him? What is he actually being charged
with? Eight charges, six counts of rape, one count of forcible sex abuse, and one count of aggravated kidnapping. Hmm.
And again, there are seven women involved in this case, seven accusers. And as you just said, prosecutors say that there was a pattern to his alleged attacks. What did that pattern look like? You said bringing him back to his apartment, a movie, sometimes an online dating app was involved in this.
Correct. Yeah. So with almost all of them, it would either be he'd pick them up outside of the student union on campus or on Tinder. And then, you know, they'd start talking. They'd meet up, and then very quickly he would, either the first or second time he met up with them, they would go back to his apartment to watch a movie. But that's not what actually happened, allegedly. So
The Salt Lake Tribune's reporting, and in fact, your own reporting, played a role here. And that's because investigations into his alleged attacks had stalled until the Tribune published a story about it. That's what got investigators to reopen those cases?
Right. So I had gotten a tip from another source that there were multiple allegations against Torrey that had not really been investigated. So I requested the police reports from Logan Police Department, and I got four of them. And none of them, two of them had been sent to the prosecutor, but the other ones hadn't really been investigated at all. And so we wrote a story about it. And after we wrote the story, the prosecutors decided to reopen the cases. And since then, they've investigated at least 14 allegations now.
In this bail hearing, Greene's attorney referenced the Tribune story, the idea being that it had influenced victims coming forward and reporting these alleged crimes. Explain that to us.
Yeah, so she referenced us a lot, actually. You know, she brought up the point that, you know, some of these women had not come forward until the story ran, which that's true. But, you know, the prosecutors tried to point out, look, they had told other people long before the story ran that either Torrey had raped them or that, you know, a football player, was telling people a football player had raped her. So, you know, their point was this is not something that they just made up after the story ran, that this was something that they had been talking about to people but had not reported it to authorities yet.
I'm going to just throw out a quick reminder to listeners that your thoughts and comments on all the stories we're covering today are welcome. Call us at 801-355-8255 if you've got a specific question about this case, or you can comment at sltrib.com. Alex, how many of the women in these charges were Utah State University students?
So at least five of them were, I believe six, but I know for sure at least five of them were students.
Okay. You know, just going back to that reporting you did, we talked about investigations languishing. Greene gets drafted by the Atlanta Falcons in the NFL. Kind of maybe a rough question, but would this trial be happening? And maybe this is a question for George Pyle, without the stories that the Tribune published. That's maybe a
I mean, no, I don't think so. They weren't. They have since said, well, these cases are never really closed. But they, the last time they talked to one of the original four women who reported was in January. I mean, these were not being investigated. So
I think it's an interesting point. And George Pyle, reporting can often seem like it's just words going out into the ether. But in this instance, Salt Lake Tribune reporting has so far had a very real world effect. How often do you see that being the case? Well, I mean, obviously, people getting informed is a real world effect. But
well, you know, as an editorial writer, I certainly sympathize with the idea that the words go out into the ether and nothing ever happens. But this reporting at US, the reporting that the Tribune did with the situation at USU, the reporting that the Tribune did with the situation at Brigham Young University, brought out of the shadows really serious problems. And it's not just there. I mean, they just fired the president of Baylor University for similar goings on. The Kansas City Star is onto a case now at the University of Kansas involving a female who was on their rowing team who was assaulted by another athlete, wound up having to leave the school. More and more of the newspapers are paying attention to this. What's even more important is that more and more victims are coming forward. And I made a crack the other day that there ought to be a Pulitzer Prize for sources because, I mean, you can have the best reporters in the world, and if people aren't willing to come forward and be identified, you know, traditionally newspapers don't identify victims or alleged victims of sexual assault cases because it's been thought for 200 years that that's too personal, that drags them before the public in a bad light for something that wasn't their fault. Even though, you know, often in cases like this, they wind up getting blamed for it. You know, what did you do? What were you wearing? Did you lead him on? All that kind of stuff. So to save people that, you just don't identify them. But when there's no face, there's no human being behind all of this, it becomes very difficult for the cases to go forward. It becomes very easy for college presidents, athletic directors, football coaches, police chiefs, mayors, everybody else to just sweep it under the rug. And I mean, with this story, I mean, first it was students at USU were reporting sexual assaults and nothing was happening. Only later did it come out that it was a football player who was being accused of all this stuff. Okay, everybody who was surprised by hearing that, you know, I got a bridge to sell you. That's always seems to be the case because those are the people whose bad dealings get covered up.
Well, it's an interesting point. And actually, just on this, Alex, I mean, first off, yes, the bravery of sources, victims coming forward and putting a face to an otherwise invisible crime. But also, the Utah State University ended up conducting its own internal investigation, but after the Tribune's reporting on this, I guess, was that, that's another result of reporting and reopening of these cases, but what did that that sort of investigation by the school itself turn up, and what happened as a result?
Well, they won't tell us what turned up. We're currently fighting that, but they are refusing to give us the actual inquiry. They've said that there's no written report. It was an internal investigation, so that's sort of concerning. But they did admit at another records committee hearing that we were fighting them for something else. They did admit that they found that they fell short with the Tory Green situation. Three of the original women that I spoke with for that first story said they told someone at the school who should have been a mandatory reporter and informed the necessary people. So we still are not sure what the inquiry says, but they have made some policy changes, and they're, you know, trying to, like, they have a consent campaign going on right now. And
at Utah State University student.
Yes.
Okay. What could Tory Greene's sentence end up looking like in this case, and what happens next? What's the time frame for his being brought to trial?
Well, I mean, he could get life in prison. I don't know that that will happen, but given the charges, that is a possibility. The next thing to happen, he has preliminary hearings in March that are actually going to stretch across 3 days because there are so many women. At the bail hearing, I think I was the only one that wasn't confused. Everyone was getting the women confused because there's so many, and, you know, they were all having trouble tracking. So I think that, you know, the 3 days was sort of necessary for them to be able to get it in line.
That's interesting. That's an interesting aspect of this. Something that we kind of glossed over and is not the most central part of the story, but part of the pattern you described involving these alleged attacks has to do with that dating app, Tinder. And I'm sure there are disclaimers when you download the app, but I guess having spoken to the women in this case, is there anyone saying anything about how dating apps like Tinder might be used by predators and if that should be reformed as well?
I haven't heard that. I never use Tinder, so I don't even know what it looks like. I mean, I think, you know, that is, I'm sure, something that will be brought up, that you were on this dating app, you know. But I mean, it seems like a way that maybe predators could find women, you know, right. But it's not really something that's been talked about yet.
Okay. Well, obviously impactful reporting carried out by Alex Stuckey, with more to come and all of it available at sltrib.com. We have a lot to cover on the program today and not a lot of time to do it in. And so right now I want to welcome to the show Salt Lake Tribune Washington correspondent Thomas Burr, who is joining us via the phone. Tommy, thanks very much for joining us on Behind the Headlines this morning.
Hey, no problem. Good morning, Roger.
Good morning. It seems almost like old news now, because other things have kind of eclipsed this, and other cabinet picks have come forward. But President-elect Donald Trump made his pick for Secretary of State earlier this week, and it wasn't Mitt Romney, or for that matter, John Huntsman Jr. Who was it?
You know, I'm disappointed by that, too, because our Book Mormon rivals could have really sold out a lot more copies. No, I joke. So President-elect Trump picked Rex Tillerson, who's the head of ExxonMobil, to be Secretary of State. It's an interesting pick. You know, he's not somebody with diplomatic experience, although he has run a multinational company, you know, with tentacles in pretty much every country across the world. So it's a new choice, and not too surprising with Mr. Trump to be somebody in the business culture. But John Huntsman and Mitt Romney, we don't know if John Huntsman actually talked to Mr. Trump. It sounds like he did never actually, you know, pay a visit to Trump Tower or have a phone call with the president-elect. Mitt Romney certainly did. He certainly was auditioning for the part. And one seriously considered, I guess from what I hear from the Trump world, is, you know, Trump really thought Romney looked the part. He was the perfect, like, TV character, which is apparently a consideration when you decide on who you're going to choose for Secretary of State.
You've got to be typecast.
But he didn't get the gig. So now it's in a tough spot, because if Romney criticizes Trump, he looks for, you know, like sour grapes in some form.
Tommy, I've seen some reports out there that, I mean, despite the fact that you're pointing out that Trump was seriously considering Romney, there are others who say that he was never a real contender. And in fact, one of Trump's informal advisors said that Trump was looking to essentially dangle this in front of Romney and kind of torture him because of some of the things that he had said during the campaign.
We may never know, to be honest. It was very clear that there was a division in the Trump world about Romney. You know, some of the senior people on Trump's team really didn't like him because of his comments he made about Trump during the primary. But, you know, I talked to a Republican friend last week who's close with the transition and was very serious about how there's no kidding that he was very seriously considered. So Trump may have very seriously considered him. The others probably said, you know, this is all about embarrassing him in some form.
Okay. I want to bring George Pyle in on this for just a second. George, there are a couple of different takes on Romney and his meetings with Trump. One, you know, on the one side, he gets criticized for meeting with this guy who he so harshly criticized in that campaign. And then the other is that he gets praised for meeting with him because it shows a willingness to kind of bury the hatchet, I guess. Your take on this?
Well, we thought it was just humiliating. And he made the speech, I think, at the University of Utah, back in March, and, you know, just unloaded on Trump and said every bad thing you could think of about him, his business, his morals, his bankruptcies, everything else, his intelligence. And then when he gets elected, all of a sudden it's, oh, you got a job? Sure, I'll talk to you. And you could make the argument that, well, you do think all those things about Trump, and you think that he's not capable of being president of the United States. But, you know, Romney thought he was capable of being president of the United States. A lot of people thought Romney was capable of being president of the United States. If he asks you to come into the cabinet, maybe you better go in just to tell the Strategic Air Command to ignore all orders from the White House on certain days. And so maybe he would have been taking one for the team if he'd have gone on there. But just the story that it was all just to humiliate Romney, I mean, everything that happened fits that scenario. I mean, like Tommy says, we don't know what's going on in Donald Trump's mind, but that's sure what it looked like from the outside. And, you know, we wrote about it, and Gail Collins in the New York Times, who loves picking on Romney, said, you know, he made this speech, and then, but for the rest of the campaign, he was gone. He could have stopped Trump. He could have thrown his support to Clinton. He could have done something to go out there and change the way it happened, and he didn't.
I want to a quick call to listeners to see how this looked to you in terms of Romney doing this. Was this a flip-flop? Was he sticking with his own, I guess, sort of convictions? The number to call, 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255, or comment at sltrib.com. You know, we should move on with this story. Tommy, Rex Tillerson, ExxonMobil CEO for Secretary of State. Some other cabinet picks from this past week include Ben Carson for Housing and Urban Development, Rick Perry for the Department of, I just can't remember the name of the department. I'm kidding.
The Department of Oops.
Yeah, the Department of Oops, Department of Energy, a name Perry couldn't remember during a debate, though it was one of the departments he planned to eliminate if he became president. And then one pick that a lot of Utahns have been waiting to hear, and that is the Interior Department. Montana Representative Ryan Zinke has been named to lead Interior, and he's held some positions that don't exactly jive well with some Utah power brokers or with Utah's elected officials in Washington. Tell us about this Interior pick.
You know, so his position is interesting. Obviously, Utah politicians, Republicans, have been very much in the mindset of trying to get the federal government to give all federal lands to the states to either sell them off or just transfer all of them to state control. That's a big thing in the West with a lot of conservatives. Ryan Zinke from Montana, this was a big issue in his campaign for reelection, and he voted against legislation earlier this year that would transfer 2 million acres of Forest Service land to the state, and actually resigned as a delegate to the Republican National Convention over the party's platform of transferring federal lands to the states. So that's inconsistent with a lot of the thinking of Utah conservatives, but it actually mirrors what President-elect Trump has said. Trump has commented before about how he doesn't want to, you know, doesn't back the idea of state control of federal lands. And that's in some ways, look, he got elected because of people in, you know, Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Michigan and, you know, kind of union people who like their public lands and want to go hunting and fishing on these public lands. So it is more in line with the president-elect's plans for Interior.
Well, maybe disappointing to those in the West who have a plan for a takeover of public lands. Robert Gerke, you wrote
well,
about this.
And one of the important advisors that Donald Trump has is his sons, and they are hunters. They're avid hunters, and so they hunt on these public lands. They've hunted in Utah, they've hunted in Arizona, Alaska, all these places, and so the idea of you know, pushing those off to the states is sort of inconsistent. Not that the state necessarily would, you know, the state argues that they're not going to sell them off, they're not going to develop them, they'll still be there for hunters. But at the same time, that's Donald Jr. And his other sons are the ones who are kind of have his ear on this issue.
Well, it's definitely the fear of environmentalists. And so what do environmentalists say about Zinke's appointment? They're, I'm assuming, somewhat pleased with that line of talking.
The ones that we've talked to, they say it could have been a lot worse. There was Cynthia Loomis from Wyoming who was being considered. There was Rogers, Representative McMorris Rogers from Washington, who was seen as probably not a good pick. There have been a number of names floated. Zinke is probably not as bad as they feared it could have been.
Robert Gerke, you wrote about Representative Rob Bishop, who says that there's a kind of an environmental spin being put on this appointment, and that it's not that actually yeah. Zinke doesn't hold this position.
I don't think he. I think he said give him time to figure out where he is on the positions. But as Tommy mentioned, this has not really been in a gray area for him on this transfer of public land stuff. He was adamant. He was outspoken. He resigned a position over it. I mean, it's not necessarily spin. It's pretty black and white. Now, that's not to say that, you know, if the administration changes and he's a good soldier, he may fall in line. But he's been pretty upfront and clear. Although, like I said, Representative Bishop says that he's a Westerner, and so he understands these issues and is going to listen and you know, give him time to see where it goes.
Robert Gerke, hold that thought. We need to take another quick break. When we return, I want to stick with the theme of Rob Bishop and public lands. You are listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We will be back in just a minute.
This is Craig Jessup. I hope you'll join us for Christmas with the American Festival Chorus and Orchestra. We'll feature holiday classics with a few fun surprises and much more. Our guest artists include Jenny Oakes Baker, Jenny Jordan Frogley, and Kurt Bester, along with the Westminster Bells. That's Christmas with the American Festival Chorus and Orchestra, Christmas Day, from noon to 2 p.m., here on Utah Public Radio.
Christmas with the American Festival Chorus and Orchestra is sponsored by Import Auto in Logan.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Robert Gerke, Christopher Smart, Thomas Burr, Alex Stuckey, and George Pyle, a full house here in the studio. Join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com. Robert Gerke, before the break, we were talking about Rob Bishop's comments on Interior Secretary nominee Ryan Zinke. You also reported this week on a wager that Bishop has going with his staff. This has to do with the proposed Bears Ears National Monument. Tell us about that.
Well, the buzz over Bears Ears has really picked up since Congress adjourned. The thinking was that the Obama administration was going to give Bishop and Chaffetz some time to get this public lands initiative through Congress. Now Congress is adjourned, and it seems teed up that the Obama administration is going to designate the Bears Ears Monument. There's some talk that it might be closer to the boundaries of the PLI. But so the Utah delegation and Governor Herbert and basically, you know, all the sort of state legislators and so forth are really pushing to the Obama administration not to create this monument. Congressman Bishop, who is chairman of the Resources Committee, says that he's convinced he's got $50 riding on the Obama administration not designating this monument. I frankly asked him if I could get a piece of that action because I think it's pretty clear at this point that's the direction all signs point to this monument coming probably next week.
Well, we won't know until it happens or until an inauguration happens and it hasn't happened. I mean,
right? We got to give it some time, I guess, before you know there is still some time. They're calling this the midnight monument. The environmentalists say that that's not the case, that the Obama administration could have done this 9 months ago, and they waited to give Bishop and Chaffetz a chance to get the public lands initiative
right
through. Now, Bishop says that, okay, even if he does designate this monument, we're still going to pass the public lands initiative next year, he's convinced, with a Republican in the White House, Republican in Senate and Congress. He's convinced they can get this through next year, and that will sort of trump, so to speak, the monument designation. And if that doesn't work, he says that Trump can shrink the boundaries, certainly, and possibly repeal the monument designation, which would end up certainly being litigated.
Well, Jason Chaffetz, Representative Chaffetz, did his own lobbying against the designation of this monument, and this was in a video, and he made some predictions about the designation leading to some kind of dire outcomes for the act that permits the monument.
Yeah, Senator Lee actually was Senator Lee who posted a video that said, you know, the Obama leg. President Obama wants this legacy as a conservationist, and he's designated, I think, Tommy, do you remember, is it 23 monuments around the country?
Yeah, I think it's 23.
And so he wants his legacy as a conservationist, and Senator Lee says, well, his legacy is going to be, if he does this, that we're going to revise or possibly repeal the Antiquities Act, the authority, the law that gives the president the authority to do this. Now, this is an act that's been in place for 110 years. Teddy Roosevelt famously started it. I think Yellowstone was one of the first. There are four of the mighty five national parks in Utah have been originally were created under the Antiquities Act and then later became national parks through acts of Congress. So this is the threat that they're making, both Bishop and Lee and others, is that if you do this, we see this as an abuse of the presidential authority, and we're going to do something to try to rein that in. Now, there have been efforts to do that in the past. There have been efforts in some states, I think Wyoming and Alaska have been exempted from the right. from the Antiquities Act. So there might be a push to do that as well. But especially with Republicans in control of Congress now in both chambers, this will probably spark some fight in the coming year.
And that's where it would happen is in Congress, as Congress can modify that. I mean, the president can't.
Sure. Congress gave him the power to do it in 1906, gave Teddy Roosevelt the power to do it in 1906, and they can take it away from Donald Trump in 2017, I guess.
Well, we're talking a lot about the groups that are lobbying against this designation. There are obviously groups that are lobbying for the designation, conservation organizations and tribal groups, mm-hmm. And their time is running low. As we know, you think that this is, as early as next week it could happen. Are these groups stepping up their efforts to try and convince the president to make this designation?
I think the groups, more than stepping up their efforts, are just trying to make sure that the president doesn't get cold feet. I think they are convinced that this is coming. But they want to make sure that it's not that the president doesn't back away. And frankly, that the designation of the monument is really just the first step. I mean, you've got from that point, right. you've got to create a resource management plan that actually governs how the monument is managed on the ground. And that's where the rubber meets the road. And you get decisions on things like road access. You get decisions like grazing. You get the important one that the Congressman Chaffetz and Congressman Bishop keep pointing to is you get what role are the tribes going to have in how that land is managed? And Congressman Bishop and Chaffetz and others say that, well, the tribes can't actually have co-management, which is what they want. But, what say are they going to have in those decisions on how the land is used?
And a lot of those decisions will be made after, obviously, the next administration takes power.
It could take years for this management plan to take shape.
George Pyle, the Tribune editorial board has, if I'm not mistaken, weighed in on this in the past, or to some extent. Actually, you weighed in on the idea floated by Rob Bishop that national monuments could be undone by the next president. How is this looking from your perspective?
Well, we are in favor of the Bears Ears Monument as proposed by the tribes. We think it would be a bad idea for somebody to designate a monument and the next president to come along and undesignate it. That's like pardoning an inmate and then the next president saying, no, you have to go back to prison. These things need to be finite at some point. Congress certainly does have the power to undo a monument or undo the whole Antiquities Act. I really doubt that would happen because really Utah is unique even in the West. We were talking about politics in Montana where they're not going for this kind of thing because they've tried it in various ways a long time ago, and they wound up with situations where the hunters and fishers couldn't get where they wanted to go, and all of a sudden beautiful forests became private land and these checkerboards that were hard to access. And so that's why the rugged outdoorsmen in Montana want no part of this. And so the idea that people in Montana and people in Michigan and Florida and Poughkeepsie and New Jersey would say, oh, yeah, we don't need the Antiquities Act. I don't see that happening.
We talked about Rob Bishop having a bet against it. Does the Tribune have a sort of pool of when this date, this announcement will come? Just out of curiosity.
Most of the talk is probably December 23rd. It would make sense for the administration to roll it out right before the Christmas holiday because then it kind of they get the splash and then the controversy dies down over the break. So look to somewhere in that time frame probably.
Guys, we are really.
And President Obama is headed to Hawaii today, actually. So he'll do this probably from Honolulu or something like that.
A nice backdrop. Tommy, we just have a couple of minutes left. In fact, about a minute's time before we have to turn to our underplayed stories of the week. But can you quickly touch on another story that you covered this week? Chris Stewart talking about Russian meddling in the U.S. election. We've been hearing about it all week long. But he disputes one part of the story being told by some members of the U.S. intelligence community. And what is it that he disputes about this?
Yeah, sure. So the reports are saying that Russia hacked the election to favor Donald Trump and to hurt Hillary Clinton. Chris Stewart, who's on the House Intelligence Committee, says, you know, from all the documents he's seen, the reports from the CIA, yes, he agrees that Russia was trying to meddle in the U.S. election, but he absolutely disagrees there was any, he calls it BS, that there was any effort to actually help Trump over Clinton. He's trying to declassify that report so we can see it ourselves, which I would love to see it, to be honest.
All right, guys, I'm sorry. Just ducking into that story, we actually have to turn now to our underplayed stories of the week. And Tommy, are you ready with an underplayed story already?
You know, I think it's fascinating that finally we're going to get some movement on this anti-fake news effort. So I guess Facebook is now going to have some kind of, you know, part that says this has been disputed if some story pops on your news feed. So people don't just buy into whatever they, you know, come across and think is actually, you know, really the truth. So that's a good step.
Third-party groups like Pointer verifying those fake news or trying to challenge those fake news. Alex Stuckey, do you have one?
Yeah, a little bit of self-promotion. But today I wrote a story in today's paper about a group of students at the U who have kind of come together and they've started a petition to try to get the university to change the way it responds to sexual assaults, especially after that controversial email that went out to students. People saying it sounds like they are saying the woman who reported a rape on Halloween is
not telling. Yeah, they're
lying,
right?
Sort of. That's what people think it says. So,
not the best message to send. And reporting at sltrip.com, Robert Gerke, your underplayed story.
Well, just real quickly, and it seems trite after what Alex is reporting about that. But the Utah Jazz have quietly taken the lead in their division and are actually playing some pretty good basketball right now and getting some national attention for a team that's gelling and sort of on the rise.
Go Jazz! Great basketball being played. Chris Martin.
I scoured the news for looking for some good news. It was hard, but I came up with some. The Utah companies that sell ultra-sweet sodas, called Dirty Sodas, are agreeing to look to settle a lawsuit. The company Swig filed a lawsuit against Sodalicious earlier when Sodalicious used the word dirty, as in dirty soda. And Swig said, that's our gig. You're stealing our trademark because dirty is not a word you can use. So they're trying to work it out.
Well, a dirty martini could have the same challenge. George Pyle, what's your underplayed story?
Okay, this is pretty cool. If you remember at the end of Fahrenheit 451, where books are banned, you wander into the woods, there are all these people out there who have memorized a book and then burned it. So it's their way of getting around the law without breaking the law. Okay, right now up in Toronto, guerrilla programmers are downloading climate data from NOAA and from NASA because they're afraid that Donald Trump might delete it from American computers. So in addition to book people, we're going to have knowledge people because you can't memorize all that data.
Reality imitating fiction. For my part, I'm going to go with a story from the Salt Lake Tribune that we didn't cover about Davis County District Attorney Troy Rawlings following the money in a case that may or may not involve retiring Nevada Senator Harry Reid, a $2 million check, online poker companies involved. Check it out at sltrib.com. Very interesting read. Alex Stuckey, Robert Gerke, Christopher Smart, George Pyle, and Thomas Burr, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining us on the show.
Thank you.
That does it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. Thanks to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, Tom Williams, and Connor Rivers at Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune's Emily Means. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Have a great weekend.
It turns out that Russians hacked the DNC to affect the election and were not very good at hiding their tracks. Investigators got in touch and said, "Are you guys Russian?" And they said, "Nyet." I'm Peter Sagal. We're reasonably sure that when Anthony Bourdain tries our quiz this week, Putin will have nothing to do with the outcome. Join us for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the news quiz from NPR.
Join us Saturday morning at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences.
KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, also heard at upr.org.